It's the 11th of August, 2019, and this is episode 407 of Let's Talk Bitcoin. On today's show, we're digging into recent disturbing developments out of India with what can only be described as the most draconian cryptocurrency law we've ever seen proposed. Later, I'm joined again by Alex Gladstein for another Global Voices Spotlight. This time, we're talking Venezuela with returning guest Alejandro Macchiato. Want to support the show? Subscribe at ltbshow.com, or if you're already subscribed, leave us a review on your favorite site or service. A big thanks to Purse.io and BlockchainTraining.org for sponsoring this episode. And if you're going to be in Colorado towards the end of this August, we'd love to see you in Denver for our live show and more at the Blockchain Training Conference Andreas has been helping organize. That's all the announcements. We'll join the other hosts now. Enjoy the show. Hey, folks. I'm Adam B. Levine. And on today's episode of Let's Talk Bitcoin, I'm here with Stephanie Murphy.
Hi there.
Jonathan Mohan.
Hey, hey.
And Andreas M. Antonopoulos.
Hello.
Thanks to all the hosts and to you, the listeners, for sitting in on today's session. So, Andreas, we were just talking about India.
Yeah, there's some disconcerting news coming out of India, where finally, after many committees, consultations, reports, and deliberations, there's been a final proposal that is being promoted as the basis for a potential law that is the most draconian, negative, fear-driven response to cryptocurrency of any country in the world, even more draconian than totalitarian countries. And this is happening in India, a democracy. It's really very upsetting.
Now, the Indian government hasn't exactly been friendly to Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies in the past either, right?
No. So this has been a slow process of kind of attrition against cryptocurrency. There was obviously the Indian government is in a position where currency control is extremely important. And the reason for that is the local currency, the rupee, has devalued greatly against other currencies. They're running big deficits and debts. And they had the failed demonetization experiment that was a complete disaster, where they suddenly declared the two most common bills in circulation invalid and required everyone to turn in their cash and issue new money. And over the past couple of years, they've pulled the rug under the local Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency industry. Most importantly, they issued a circular through the central bank that prohibited all banks from having any dealings with cryptocurrency exchanges or cryptocurrency businesses, which means that all of the exchanges had all of their bank accounts shut down. And as a result of that, essentially, there are no legal regulated exchanges in India. They had a very nice environment with many exchanges competing, very professional, very well built, and that was shut down overnight. The new bill makes things much worse.
Wow, it's hard to imagine it getting worse than that, but what happened?
Well, so you've got to consider that India has more than 5 million investors in crypto. Thousands of startups, hundreds of thousands of people working in the industry. And the new bill makes it a crime to possess, buy, or sell what they call private digital currency. So they've actually carved out a special name for digital currencies that are not controlled by the government. They are fawning all over blockchain and DLT and proposing that the central bank issues a digital rupee and uses blockchain and DLT to bring India into the modern world or some bullshit like that. And then they've classified private digital currencies, specifically mentioning Bitcoin and others, as absolutely banned.
Just banned. Like you can't use it, you can't have it, you can't possess it.
I have the quote here. It's whoever directly or indirectly mines, generates, holds, sells, deals in, transfers, disposes of, or issues cryptocurrency shall be punished with a fine or imprisonment, which shall not be less than 1 year, but which may extend up to 10 years or both.
Wait, so you can't hold it and you can't dispose of it. So what are you supposed to do?
Well, let me give you a bit of context here. The maximum penalty for rape in India is 7 years. The maximum penalty for drug crimes is 7 years. The maximum penalty for holding a private digital currency is now 10 years. And the monetary fine is approximately $4 million in US terms.
But wait, hang on. Whoever directly or indirectly promotes, issues any advertisements, solicits, abets, or induces any participation in any activity involving the use of cryptocurrency shall be punished with a fine or imprisonment, which may extend up to 7 years. So don't worry, they treat the promotion the same as they do as, you know, rape or other crimes like that.
Right. I cannot go to India and do a talk, because if I delivered a talk in India like I've done before, this time I would be a rupee rapist.
So this is the most draconian type of move that we've actually seen
in the world. This is worse than Venezuela, worse than North Korea. I mean, it is astonishing. And here's the other thing. Between the promote, hold, buy, sell, etc., and the prison fines, keep in mind, as Stephanie said, you can't hold it, but you can't sell it. Now, in the meantime, right now, there's no exchanges operating in India. So people who already hold it can't sell it, because if they do, they can't put it in the bank account because their bank account will get shut down by the banks. And it is illegal to export currency instruments from the country. That's always been the case. It's a very serious fine. So none of the exchanges and none of the individuals can move their crypto out of the country. So you can't sell it abroad. So this is not a law yet. This is a proposal. But there's a very good chance it will become law. And there's a huge risk here, because this is in the context of the government of Narendra Modi being reelected recently in a landslide election that gave them complete and absolute control of both tiers of the government and effectively absolute control for the next 5 years. They have a full majority. Any law they can imagine, they can pass. Passing is not the issue. And this report, among other things, has the influence of cabinet members in the Ministry of Finance and other ministries who are hell-bent on criminalizing every aspect of cryptocurrency. And they're likely going to pass a law very close to this, if not this.
Can we dust all those government officials with a little bit of Bitcoin or something so that they would be criminalizing themselves if they pass this?
Well, I mean, I don't think that's a problem. They're probably stuffing their crypto wallets as we speak.
Right.
Because, you know, again, laws like this, which are so draconian, ridiculous in nature, breed corruption, right? Because they're not going to be applied equally. They're going to try and pick one or two people to make an example of. And if you speak up against this, I guess that would be promoting, right? So they'll get you there. And it's the perfect recipe for corruption. It's really, really disappointing. And the reason it's disappointing is not because they're criminalizing this and making a whole bunch of people into criminals, which is terrible for the people involved. It's worse for the 1.5 billion people who desperately need this type of technology in their country, and the hundreds of thousands of people who worked in a thriving industry that was doing incredibly good work, and they basically shut that down. So the damage is going to be much broader and much longer, not the people who have crypto today, but the people who will never be able to get crypto because that would make them a criminal and therefore can't participate in this industry at all. So basically, India has been cut off from Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, but only criminals in India will have it.
So when it comes to Indian law, because America, especially when it comes to money, it applies, you know, on Earth and above Earth. Like, I'm pretty sure astronauts still file their taxes on time. In India, though, let's say I'm a brilliant Indian engineer, this law passes, and I have every available opportunity to meet in the world, so I take a job offer for a blockchain company in America. Is that still in violation of that law? Would I be subject to violating that provision when I come back home? Would I then be in exile?
From what I understand, different conditions apply to non-resident Indians.
I think that another kind of angle on that question, Jonathan, is what happens to the teams that are working in India remotely? Because that's a real thing. Like, there's a lot of remote work that happens in the space that comes out of India or, you know, those types of areas.
Well, they can't work. I mean, if you include all of those little words, they have to quit their jobs, even if they're not being paid in crypto. They can't even work on the software.
So this really is a disconnection fundamentally of India from the rest of the world that's working on this stuff. at least in a legal sense.
It's the one area where North Korea is more connected than India may soon be.
So, you know, this makes it hard to get or use Bitcoin in India, but for people who already have crypto within India, like, this makes what they're doing, like, retroactively illegal, again, assuming that it passes in a form similar to what we've seen, but there's nothing actually stopping them from getting, account at an exchange in another country and then sending the Bitcoin there. It's not like India is tracking the individual's Bitcoin, at least at this point.
Well, again, I think how this is enforced is a whole different question, right? And how it's enforced is intimidation, selective prosecution, right? If you f*** with a government and they find that in addition to everything else, you have 1 millibit in a wallet, now they can throw you in jail for 10 years. So it gives them a mechanism to impose extremely harsh punishments on people who are politically dissident. The other thing is, the moment this law passes, every Indian desperately needs Bitcoin. I mean, what this tells you about your government, and this is something we've discussed in the past, is if your government is behaving like this, this is when you absolutely need Bitcoin, because your government is signaling exactly what it's going to do next with money. This is about closing all of the exits. If you're on a cruise ship and the captain says, lock down all the bulkhead doors and burn all the lifeboats, you're like, what are you planning exactly here? Right?
Right.
So I think that there's one more angle to talk about this story from, which is that it specifically uses the term private cryptocurrency to describe what's happening. And as you said, Andreas, in the intro to this, it speaks pretty favorably about distributed ledger technology. So I think the implication is that they're interested in the technology, they just don't want versions of it that they don't have control over. Is that true, Reid, as well?
It's absolutely about control.
Could the conflation with the word private also be instigated as a slapback response to Facebook? Because they were very antagonistic to that when it came out. And I think the word private, rather than public or protocol or any sort of distinction towards a technology versus a commercial actor, it seems like we're getting in that three-body problem you were referring to. It sort of seems like two of us are getting clumped together for the deeds of one.
Yeah, that's very, very likely. But I think it's also the Indian government has been getting increasingly authoritarian and has always been a bit of a, let's say, a nanny state, right? Like, it's always been a democracy in which if the government says so, you ask for permission and you don't ask too many questions about why the government says so. They just did. So, you know, follow the rules. So from that perspective, it's not a country where the idea that if it's not illegal, why can't I do it applies. It's always surprising when people say, well, can I do this? Do I have permission? It's the exact opposite of, let's say, the attitude you have in America, which is ask for forgiveness, right? And if it's not illegal, that means it's legal. That's not how things work in India.
So as we all know, and as we see examples with drugs, alcohol, other historical examples of prohibitions on anything, prohibiting something by law doesn't wave a magic wand and make it go away, as much as the legislators might wish that or say that's what they wish for. It just drives it underground. And so, of course, if this law is passed in India, Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are not going to go away, private cryptocurrencies, right? Like they call them. They're not going to go away. They're just going to exist in sort of an underground way. And so people are going to find some way of forming networks where they can meet up and trade cryptocurrencies, perhaps at great risk to themselves if these laws are really being enforced on those kinds of networks or if there's crackdowns. And that means there's going to be a price premium, just like we see with drugs.
I'm kind of excited. I mean, I also like to always think of the positive in every outcome. And what we now have, if this passes, the most direct material pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for the first protocol to meaningfully create obfuscation, plausible deniability, and methods of transacting that you cannot validate or cross-correlate identity on for, you know, a fourth of the human race. I can't remember what it is, but it's something like India builds the equivalent of the entire city of Chicago, like every month or every week or some insane number of days, like incremented in days. So if a fourth of the human race is now locked off to a requirement set of all of the values that we keep saying we want, but no one prioritizes because it's not really that important to any of us, we now, if this passes, have that pot of gold. And I'm really excited for the direct focus that the first protocol to actually hit those targets will have in becoming India's Bitcoin. Because I don't think Bitcoin will be the first to that. I want it to be the first to that. But whoever now does that, I think will win that market.
So you're saying that this will be an incentive to create more privacy-focused protocols for Bitcoin wallets and software?
If the capacity to use Bitcoin or transaction methods that are entirely directed and you can, you know, use chain analysis to determine who they are becomes an inhibiting factor, the first protocol that meets those requirements is going to rapidly be adopted and expanded in a way that the others cannot.
It's about changing the priorities, right? So from my experience of the Indian market, I think there were primarily two drivers for cryptocurrency adoption. The more obvious and first order incentive or priority was investment opportunity. So people who had a bit of disposable income or some investment income in India and did not have available to them the range of investment opportunities of a Western investor and wanted to invest in things that are outside of the country, uncorrelated with the country or modern tech and things like that, used not just Bitcoin, but the whole range of altcoins that were all the rage in India to invest and build kind of portfolios. I think the second strongest incentive was store value, right? Again, India demonetization, devaluation has been happening now for years. The trajectory for the Indian economy indicates there's going to be more of that. So in terms of preservation of capital, the rupee is not where you want to be holding your money. Indians, of course, have a historical affinity to gold, and it's very difficult to shift that mentality. So there were some people who saw Bitcoin as an equivalent, but also heavy investment in gold.
Yeah. Until Indians give their, you know, one-year-old daughter a Bitcoin bangle, I won't really believe it'll have the same impact.
Yeah, exactly. And so those were the two primary motivations. Now, of course, I think this has shifted the motivations. So this draconian law means that the people who need to use crypto are people who are doing things where absolute privacy is a necessity and where currency controls are getting in the way of what they're doing, which means, honestly, we're going to see a lot more money launderers using crypto instead of retail investors. And, you know, as the saying goes, if you make something illegal, only criminals can use it and criminals will. And so in this particular case, what this is going to do is encourage the kind of crypto in India that is really privacy focused, obfuscation focused, deniability focused, etc., which is going to pour money into those kinds of cryptos, primarily for nefarious activities.
What I wonder is, what is the general attitude of people in India about cryptocurrency? Is this going to be like the internet firewall in China, where a lot of people are just going to have no problem getting around it? Is this going to be like speed limits on US highways, where everybody knows it's kind of okay to go like 10 over? Or is it going to be something that really has people afraid and shaking in their shoes?
I'm not that familiar with the culture, but I've been to India several times and I've talked to people there about this law. I would expect that the vast majority of people will not touch this ever again. So as long as this law exists, the people who have crypto are going to try to find a way to exit rapidly. And the vast middle class and the vast poverty class in India will not touch crypto ever again because they've been told by their governments that this is criminal. And that will leave a very, very small sliver of the population who are willing to break these laws. And most Indians are very law abiding, so they will follow this law.
This is also not particularly a new thing. This seems like it's kind of an extreme escalation at the end of what they've been doing for a while. A couple of episodes ago, we talked with Aparna Krishnan, who actually did a study of kind of rural users and kind of unbanked users in India, figuring out why they were unbanked. And a lot of it had to do with complexity, and a lot of it had to do with basically not understanding how to use what was kind of already there in the existing system, regardless of whether you're talking about cryptocurrency or some other form of remote banking. But the thing was, though, they've had controls on exchanges in India for so long at this point that the liquidity implications, I actually wonder how many of those there really are. The thing that's different about this is that this seems like it makes it illegal to actually even just have cryptocurrency. Whereas before, it was very, very difficult to trade cryptocurrency because they had cracked down on exchanges, but you could still hold it. So I wonder how easy it will be even for this mass to liquidate if they wanted to.
That's exactly the problem. I don't think it will be easy. This is a total catch-22 law.
Yeah, where like really the only game theory that works is now we know that this draft law exists. So if you're somebody who wants to follow the law in India and you have cryptocurrency, then you have to get rid of it like immediately. But again, there's no mechanism to do that because the exchange infrastructure doesn't exist there.
Well, you got to spend it, right? Got to see if Perse delivers to India, I guess.
Yeah, it's a very, very frustrating situation. And I think we got to see this in the broader political context of what's happening in India. And I'm going to speak from my understanding, which is extremely limited. So please forgive me if I get major things wrong. But you've got to realize that the Modi government is incredibly popular, not necessarily in the middle class urban centers, but certainly in the broader country. They're populist and fairly puritanical. So this isn't just crypto we're talking about. This is a government that believes in many forms of control over people's behavior, including drinking, alcohol, and other behavioral regulations in India. They're strict, they're conservative, populist, and very, very popular. So, you know, it's part of a broader theme that we see across the world. I don't want to compare leaders and cultures, of course, because they're very, very different. But it's always weird to Westerners when they realize that people like Putin are incredibly popular in Russia because of nationalism and populism and, you know, a golden age that has gone by. Same thing with Erdogan in Turkey. Same thing with Modi in India. These are incredibly popular leaders who have swayed a massive population and are using that to promote very conservative policies. And it's surprising to outsiders and people who come from a Western ideology, but that's the case on the ground. So, you know, if you think that this is going to cause Indians to do a monetary rebellion where they all turn into anarcho-capitalists and whatever, not going to happen. Quite the opposite, in fact. So it's really a huge disappointment for an industry that was thriving and is now basically dead in a very important country in the world.
To our Indian listeners out there, we'd love to hear from you and hear your perspective on these things.
Yeah, and we don't need your name or your holdings or any acknowledgments of future, present, or past holdings.
Whether you're an NRI or you're somebody who's actually based in India today, reach out, Adam, at letstalkbitcoin.com. We'd love to get your perspective. Hey folks, Adam B. Levine here with Matt from Perse.io for another Sponsored Minute. Hey Matt.
Hey Adam.
So Matt, Perse is a for-profit company, really a startup, but from our conversations, it sounds like you guys spend a lot of time and resources developing stuff that's free and open source.
Yeah, it's true. Perse makes a direct profit from its Bitcoin Amazon exchange platform, but there's something even more valuable to us than just selling a service, Bitcoin itself. Everyone at Perse is a longtime holder of Bitcoin, our founders, our investors, and our developers. So we all benefit when the price goes up, regardless of how the Perse application is performing. To that end, we employ a team of open source developers that work full-time on creating secure, easy-to-use tools for interacting with Bitcoin. As a community manager for Bitcoin, I can tell you I've heard from developers around the world who are integrating the Bitcoin library into their projects. I worked with one developer who recently left Venezuela, and he's building a wallet system to help his family and friends back home deal with their financial situations. If we can help spread Bitcoin adoption around the world, we all benefit.
To start saving today, visit purse.io. And for more information about Bitcoin, visit bcoin.io or just look it up on GitHub. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Adam.
Hey, folks. Adam B. Levine here again with Alex Gladstein for the Human Rights Foundation for another interview showcasing perspectives and voices from beyond the borders of our everyday experience. For today's conversation, we're joined by returning guest Alejandro Macchiato. Alejandro, how are you?
Hi, Adam. I'm doing well. How are you?
I am well. So we've been having a lot of fun talking about, you know, kind of the experience of cryptocurrency in other places. And that's why we wanted to have you back on to talk about Venezuela and really any other place in sort of the South American sphere where you feel like you have a good grasp on it. So feel free to answer for all of those.
I'll do my best.
Okay.
I've been researching this issue for the past year since we talked. That kind of became my full-time interest. It became what I do for a living as well. So yeah, happy to answer, especially about Venezuela, but we do know a little bit more about Colombia as well. I also spent some time in Argentina last year, and I've seen some of the things coming out of there.
So given that you've been on the show before, why don't you just give us a really brief background up until the point that you were on with us last year, and then you can give a more kind of expanded background from that point to now.
Sure. So I studied computer science in undergrad, started in 2007, and I graduated in 2013. Then I did a master's in human-computer interaction. So I am a little bit in between the world of the technologists, the coders, the developers, and the world of the designers, the world of the product people. I enjoy doing both technology development and thinking about the broader questions of what a product should be and how to design products. And that, up until last year, was what I was doing. I was consulting and doing work for several startups. And then I decided that, you know, this Bitcoin thing in Venezuela was very big and very important. And it could also be very impactful to get into that because there's not enough people that are thinking about Bitcoin in terms of, you know, how can we make sure that it helps people in economically oppressed societies. And that happened around June of last year. I went to ZCon. I met up with Jill Carlson and Zuko, and they had already started this kind of product market fit research for the electric coin company. And they wanted to see whether it made sense to develop a strategy for Venezuela because, you know, as everyone in the industry knows, there is a lot of cryptocurrency use in Venezuela relative to other countries. And there wasn't a lot of information out there that was very reliable about, you know, like there were some anecdotes about people using Bitcoin, some people mining and some people being confiscated, you know, the whole ordeal with the Petro, which we talked extensively about last time we talked. So there was a lot of potential to dig deeper and to understand what the potential was, both for humanitarian aid and supporting people who may need access to financial systems because they have no alternative. And also, you know, what else is going on there? Is there some speculation going on? Is there, you know, some conflation with the Petro? So we looked into all of those things first as part of the Zcash and Electric Coin Company special project that we did over the summer. But then we got together and realized that this was an effort that should be undertaken by a more broad constituency. Like it should be backed by the industry as a whole, and it should be able to influence the narrative and the products that are used throughout the industry, especially the products that are already being used in Venezuela. So, you know, there are some products like RTM, local Bitcoins that are being used in Venezuela, and we hope we'll be able to influence. So we decided to spin off of the Zcash company, and Zuko was also a big supporter of us, and we were very grateful that he kind of helped us take that push. And we created this nonprofit called the Open Money Initiative, and also Alex and Human Rights Foundation have been very helpful in the founding of the organization. The Human Rights Foundation is our fiscal sponsor, and we work with them very closely. So it's been a fun year. It's been a very hectic year, like just creating this new organization. And so in the beginning was Jill Carlson and I, and then we partnered up with Jamal Montessor, who is a designer at IDEO. And we decided to go, like, for a fresh project, we wanted to do a design research project in Venezuela where we would go and interview people. We would do ethnographic interviews of around 2 hours to really understand how people are using money in Venezuela. We aren't just looking for people who are using Bitcoin necessarily. We're looking for kind of outliers, you know, both the people that will use Bitcoin and that are very savvy and know how to trade it and mine it and so on, and the people who have no idea and maybe they aren't even curious, but they have other hacks for the financial system, because we're not focused primarily on, or exclusively, let's say, in cryptocurrencies, but we are focused on how people might be able to get access to open financial systems and how these people are hacking it in a way that they can get exposure to various currencies, like the US dollar, for example, is very important. Around the border of Colombia and Venezuela, we're seeing that there's a lot more use of Colombian peso. And this is very similar to what happened in Zimbabwe in 2008, when the currency was also collapsing. You saw that the South African rand was making inroads into the country near the border with South Africa. And then in the capital, it was mostly US dollars and oftentimes in cash.
Alejandro, you know, a lot of people have seen Venezuela in the news. I think a lot of people have maybe a decent understanding of the political crisis, but could you kind of like simply and relatively concisely walk us through the economic crisis that's happened over the last few years? Like, what hyperinflation has done to the average person? How do they get money from their families abroad or from their businesses abroad? And how do they send money? And why local Bitcoins, for example, as an exchange, has been such an interesting lifeline for people?
Yeah, so it's kind of a complex topic, and it's been years in the making. And I'm not an economist, so I don't know what I say is just the recollection of things that I have gathered from other people that know way more than me in economics and studying public policy and so on. But basically, the Venezuelan crisis is a self-inflicted crisis. It's something that for years, the policy makers of Chavismo, who is the ruling party of Venezuela, they heard from advisors, you know, if you do this, if you print more money, if you spend money, like unlimited amounts of money in, you know, social services and social policies that, you know, you can't measure the effectiveness of, if you just use the windfall of oil and spend it all, you're not going to be able to survive. You're not going to be able to maintain the economy. And for years, like, they listened to these people say this and they never really paid attention. They never really corrected course, because what the doomsday predictions weren't materializing, because Venezuela had an oil boom that lasted quite a bit. And especially from 2011 to 2014 or so, the state had so much surplus of money. Venezuela has always been a country rife with corruption. So what happened was that most of that money was just stolen by individuals, by companies, by people with access, privileged access to government. So the government heard about, you know, the disastrous consequences that their policies will truly have. And since they didn't materialize in, you know, the years where 2011, 2014, they believed they were invincible.
Can you be a little more specific, meaning they were like a surplus of oil allowed them to be reckless with regard to printing money? Or could you be a little more specific about that?
Yeah. So like they were reckless about printing money, but they were also reckless about spending the money that they had, stashing it away in tax havens and so on. That all contributed to the crisis. But yes, like let's say from 2017, which is where hyperinflation started, the government has just ramped up their operations of printing money, and that has only accelerated the crisis. And when we talk about hyperinflation, we talk about an inflation rate of over 50% month over month. So if you can imagine something costing, you know, $10 today, and next month it costs $15. That's the kind of inflation we're talking about. And now in Venezuela, it's much more accelerated. Things are doubling in price every couple of weeks or so. It's really difficult to imagine how to live in a society where you can't predict what things will cost. You basically, what people are resorting to today is pegging their prices to the dollar. They just quote the price in dollars, and then you work out how much it is at the moment that you have to pay. And that is something that is very frowned upon by the government, because the government believes that there's a conspiracy to oust them, and they have all this rhetoric against the US government. So especially the US dollar is something that they really, really oppose. They have been historically punishing people who post prices in dollars or who charge in dollars. And that's been very haphazard. Like, that hasn't been like a state policy that says it's illegal to trade in dollars. What has been illegal all these years from 2003 or 2004 to today has been the trading, individuals trading dollars for local currency, for bolivars. So the government had to approve those trades. Nowadays, now that the government has run out of policy options and they keep printing money, but it's not enough to contain the crisis, what they are defaulting to do now is to be a little bit more liberalized with currency exchange enforcement. So like, while there are some laws that haven't been taken out that say that it's illegal to trade or that there is this perception that it's frowned upon to trade in dollars, the government is no longer so much enforcing these rules. So it seems like we're seeing the start of people being able to trade dollars for bolivars more freely. But, you know, there is a big effect of people being afraid of what the government might do.
And the government is still blocking foreign IP addresses from interacting with Venezuelan banks, right?
Yeah, from banking in Venezuela. You can't bank in a Venezuelan bank if you're living outside the country, for example. You need to ask someone who is there. Or, you know, you can tunnel and use technology to fool the bank's servers.
So for millions of Venezuelans in this climate of hyperinflation and capital controls, could you just briefly walk us through, if I didn't know what Bitcoin was or cryptocurrency was, how would I receive money from, let's say, my family in Miami? And then if I did, how would I do that? And how quickly could I turn, let's say, Bitcoin that my family sends me into bolivars?
Yeah. So the main way that people are trading bolivars for dollars is by tapping into their networks and finding someone. So for example, if I have a friend who I want to send money to, or a family member who I want to send money to, let's say I'm in the United States and I have a US bank account, I need to find someone, a counterparty that has a US bank account and that wants to sell me bolivars. So I transfer money from my US account to his US account. And then this person would have a US account and also a bolivar account in Venezuela. So there are still some business people, some people who have various interests in the country that at some times or other times, they need either access to bolivars or access to dollars. People need access to dollars in Venezuela because everything that you need to import, you need access to hard currency. And people still need bolivars in Venezuela because it is the currency that is the most widespread. And ordinary people don't have access to dollar accounts. So it is very hard for them to just say, I want to just accept dollars. And also, as we mentioned earlier, there's a perception that the government will crack down on this. Whether they do it or not, there is a fear, right? So it is a cumbersome process because I need to find someone that wants to sell me at the right moment the right amount of dollars so that I can convert them into bolivars. So as you can imagine, this has become kind of a profession. So people who have dollar accounts in the US, say, or in Panama, or, you know, euro accounts in Europe, and also they are banked in Venezuela, they maintain several balances in their several banks, and they function as traders, and obviously they earn a commission for it. But as of today, there's no system that aggregates all of the offers, so it's very haphazard. It depends heavily on who you know and who you can trust, and there's lots of scams, and lots of people are getting fooled by people who appear to be trustworthy. But then when you do a transaction that's big enough for someone to say, okay, I'm going to just stop dealing with this customer, or this is a $10,000 transaction, I'm just going to take this and run away and like just leave Venezuela, because many people are leaving Venezuela today, they might run some exit scams. And it's very difficult to really be able to trust sending the money in this way, which is called a hawala system, right? And then if you do know how to use Bitcoin, or if you know what Bitcoin is and you have an account in local Bitcoins, which is not technically very hard, but there are some hurdles for those people who maybe don't know what Bitcoin is, or they're not very familiar with web tools, and maybe they don't have computers. There are some obstacles, right, to the use of some tools like local Bitcoins. But if you can overcome that, and it's not a very big barrier if we're speaking about people who have access to a computer and people who are educated and so on, you can go online and you can send bolivars to your family in about 15 minutes. So what you need to do is you need to have some Bitcoin in your local Bitcoins account, and then you go to the Venezuela page and you can find around 10 or 11 pages of traders that are willing to trade with you. And it's a very liquid market.
To give some scope, we were looking at this, Alejandro, that it was something like, you know, depending on the day, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times the volume traded on local Bitcoins in Bolivar right now than on the stock market in Caracas. which is a low bar because there's not a lot of activity on the Caracas stock market.
That's right.
But it still is a paradigm shift, obviously, in the way that, you know, a country and its economy is moving. It's kind of amazing, no?
Yeah, it is kind of amazing. I think if you are a person who just wants to use a product to turn dollars or Bitcoin into bolivars and vice versa, local Bitcoins is that product today. You know, it's what is being used today. There are some other attempts to facilitate this. There's also, for example, ARTM. Local Ethereum, to a lesser extent, is also used for this.
So kind of early on in our conversation, you mentioned that you worked with Zcash on the Open Money Initiative, and you did these sort of long form interviews, deep dives into kind of what I want to summarize as how to work with money when money doesn't work.
Yes, exactly. That's the great way to put it.
I'd love to hear what you learned from that or what your big takeaway was. We've typically been asking people, you know, like, is it Bitcoin? Is it, you know, something else? And do transaction fees matter? But I feel like this maybe wraps all of that together.
Let's start with the Bitcoin question. So we found that there is a little bit of Bitcoin use, and it's very difficult to quantify. We didn't set out to gather statistically significant results. We can't really quantify, oh, there's 5% of the population in Venezuela is using Bitcoin. We have no data around that, but we do have data on what the people that are using Bitcoin, how are they using it and what they're using it for. So we know that there are some people that, as I mentioned earlier, are using it to handle remittances through the use of localbitcoins.com, for example. There are some people that used to mine or still mine and have a stash of Bitcoin, and they use it for their expenses. So they have their savings. Bitcoin is their savings account, their Bitcoin wallet, and they cash out whenever they need to do a Bolivar purchase, and they do this through local Bitcoins. There are some freelancers that are charging, sometimes in Bitcoin, sometimes they use like a family member's bank account in the US, for example, and they keep their money there, and they keep, you know, local accounting of how much money they have there and so on. So there are several hacks that people are using when money doesn't work. What we would like to do as the Open Money Initiative is to broaden access to the systems that exist today that are permissionless, that are available to anyone, and lower the bar of difficulty of use, start designing products that could really cater to the people who don't yet have access to these tools. Because we know from our research that there appears to be significant overlap between services like local Bitcoins, RTM, Uphold, Payoneer, all of these digital money tools that people are resorting to, they're being used by the same population. It's like, you know, the younger, the people who are more tech savvy, the people who maybe have a job or like a part-time gig that they do online so that they can round up their salaries, because salaries in Venezuela don't amount to much. So we know that there is significant use and very heavy use, I would say, by these like very limited population. But our question is, how do we open that up to every single person? In a similar way that WhatsApp opened up the possibility to contact almost anyone in the world, you know, they just really focused on being available on every phone, no matter how old, no matter how difficult it was to program for that. You know, we kind of need that moment in cryptocurrency. We know, for example, that in Venezuela, there's lots of people who have phones with Android 4.x or 5.0. And, you know, developers today are very focused on, oh, let's make this very pretty app with animations and, you know, like we can leverage the best of iOS 12 and so on. And, you know, that there's something exciting about building technology in a way that is very current and, you know, very easy to deal with the newest SDKs and so on. And also, you know, the building of desktop applications and web applications and so on. But I think the industry has to come to terms with the fact that most people that really need this, in our opinion, they have older phones and they don't have computers. They're not very tech savvy. So like, how can you make something like what WhatsApp did in the product space for money management and sending and receiving money? Is there maybe a possibility to have wallets integrated with exchanges or different kind of services that would kind of match the way people are using money today? You know, like people are sharing bank accounts, for example. Is there a way that we could have a shared bank account product that would make sense for people in Venezuela or people in Nigeria or people in India? And that perhaps would get us the best features of cryptocurrency without the complexities. So for example, if you could abstract away the fact that there's Bitcoin or there's a currency that fluctuates for example, how Abra is doing with hedging contracts, and they keep a stable balance in your wallet, and the user doesn't really need to know. It's in the terms of service if the user wants to know, but I think there are some ways that people can confidently use money instruments without really knowing how they operate in the background. So this could be accomplished with, there are like stable coins, there are hedging contracts, there are ways that, you know, you could give people what they want, which today in Venezuela seems to be access to the US dollar, but in ways that is easy for them to access and is actually available for everyone who may have a smartphone. And in Venezuela, infrastructure is collapsing and we're losing a lot of connectivity and now there's blackouts. So every day it gets a little harder, but there is still enough penetration of smartphones and internet in the country that it would really make a difference.
Do you think that Venezuela is likely to be one of the first places to make a comprehensive change to some type of cryptocurrency, whether de facto or officially? Or do you think that the kind of extraordinary pressures that are being brought to bear, not just on the financial system, but on the people as a whole, that these things are actually disadvantages right now to adoption?
That's a very tough and very good question. I certainly hope that we are in time to make the changes and to spread products that really change people's lives. You know, and these have to be digital products. They still will rely on the internet. They still will rely on electricity availability. Last year, for example, it looked easier to do than it does this year, because this year we have seen the extent of how the electrical grid is in shambles. I don't know if you follow the situation, but there was a four-day long blackout. Like 80% of the country was without electricity. And now, you know, it's not only that, but there are programmed blackouts, or maybe not so programmed. The electric grid is analog and is owned by the state. And they are the only ones who can fix the problem. And it doesn't seem like they have enough engineering talent or skills or, you know, people working there to fix the problem. And also, you know, it's a battle against time. The phones that people have, people can't afford new ones. There's been, I think, a concerted effort from the state in not investing in internet infrastructure so that we don't get fast internet or we don't get good coverage. But still, like, despite all of those things, I think there is still an opportunity for having, you know, a set of products that really, really caters to the Venezuelan population, or really caters to, let's say, where conditions are suboptimal, because the government itself needs the infrastructure operating at a base level. Because, for example, we mentioned that they printed a lot of money. Most of the money that they print is electronic money. They don't even have enough money to print the money in physical paper. So people are forced to using electronic money. And if electronic money doesn't work, you know, in terms of you being able to send money from your phone or from your computer to someone else, or using a debit card, all of those things today in Venezuela, they need to work. And the government has to ensure that they work. Otherwise, commerce cannot occur. And what's going to happen is that people are going to fall back into US dollars in cash. So, you know, the government has an incentive to still provide at least a minimal level of connectivity, because they themselves have to coordinate and they need to allow people to transact. So that can be an opportunity that we can leverage to push for a more open money system.
Just a final note building off that. Obviously, we saw Juan Guaido knows what Bitcoin is, has seen it being used. If the dictatorship falls, and in the next year, there's this sort of opposition party that comes into power and the rebuilding process begins, which is, I think, the most optimistic outcome anyone could hope for politically. Where do you think the new government, let's say, you know, where they would see Bitcoin as far as their economic roadmap moving forward, or let's say any open cryptocurrency versus, you know, the Bolivars, or just strictly officially dollarizing?
Yeah, I saw Guaido tweeting about Bitcoin. I didn't see it when he tweeted it. This was, I think, 2014, but I did see it after, you know, he came to prominence and, you know, was picked up by crypto Twitter. So it's exciting that, you know, the president is now thinking about these things. And if he is able to overturn the dictatorship, you know, I think this is something that the new government will think about. And besides the policy, the specific policy that the government will take, I think the most interesting question is, what will people do? Like, once we get out of this nightmare, I think people will always remember that relentless money printing and, you know, hyperinflation and all of this crisis was something that could have been avoided by taking responsibility for yourself on how you can handle your own money. And, you know, it wasn't something that was preventable from the beginning because Bitcoin wasn't available. People didn't know. The government has been historically the one responsible for keeping currency stable. And, you know, it is still today, you know, in places like Europe, the US, we're not, I don't think, going to see a replacement of government managed money in favor of cryptocurrencies. But I think in Venezuela, it could still be, when we get out of this nightmare, it could be seen as an alternative, an option that is always there, that, you know, if we see the signs pointing again towards monetary mismanagement, towards relentless money printing, we will still have, as long as we can have access to the internet and as long as we have infrastructure that is recovering and, you know, we are pointing towards development and progress, we will have the option to opt into cryptocurrency and to keep part of our money there. So I think, for example, that may happen as well with Argentina. Argentina has always had problems with high inflation. And now that they've had even moments in their history where Argentina citizens were able to have dollars in their bank accounts, but these dollars quickly got converted arbitrarily to Argentinian pesos with no advance announcement. And, you know, it was kind of a promise that wasn't upheld. So if you can be reasonably sure that there's a software system that fulfills that promise on its own with a global market for a currency, and this is what I want to stress the most, is that Bitcoin by itself is a wonderful system, very technically compelling, it's beautiful, but what we need is for Bitcoin to be liquid in global markets so that if in one specific country there's a loss of freedom, there's a loss of ability to trade your money for another arbitrary currency, then there's always at least the option to trade your money for Bitcoin because there is a local market that can emerge there. And I think local Bitcoin is a part of this vision that is happening today, but it might become more important in the future. But then you can leverage Bitcoin to transform that money into wherever you are going to go. So if you're going to Colombia, for example, you could gradually save in Bitcoin because you're the open system that's available to you. And then when you finally do the switch and cross over, you can transform the Bitcoin that you have into Colombian pesos if you feel like you must now integrate into the Colombian economy. So we also saw some people doing this with gold in Venezuela. You know, people, they invested their life savings in gold, they crossed the border, and then when they got to the other side, they could sell their gold. But if we could do this in a way that is even less risky by just having a password in your head. And what we need to do is to make sure that this grows from a very niche and very specialized knowledge to something that everyone can use, everyone can benefit from.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Let's Talk Bitcoin. Today's show is sponsored by Purse.io and BlockchainTraining.org. It featured content by Andreas Antonopoulos, Stephanie Murphy, Jonathan Mohan, Adam B. Levine, Alex Gladstein, and Alejandro Macchiato. Music for this episode was provided by Jared Rubens and General Fuzz, with editing by Stephen Aram. For all you listeners who subscribed a long time ago to the All Shows feed on the LTB Network, I encourage you to go to ltbshow.com and subscribe to our new feed to get access to episodes a day early, get exclusive bonus content, and to avoid any potential future disruptions. Any questions or comments? Email Adam at ltbshow.com. We'll see you next time.